Today on Maine Calling, the legacy of Charles Norman Shea, an encore presentation. The newest ferry in Maine, commissioned last month in Rockland, is the Charles Norman Shea. It is named after a living hero who turned 100 earlier this year. On D-Day, Shea, a combat medic and Penobscot tribal member, saved many lives. After making it to shore safely, he turned back and, under gunfire, pulled injured soldiers from the water. Shea received the Silver Star for his heroism, and today there is a monument to him and other Native American soldiers at Omaha Beach. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today, on Indigenous Peoples Day, we listen back to our earlier conversation about Charles Norman Shea. We learn more about his remarkable story and how his service reflects a long history of Wabanaki soldiers fighting for the U.S. in every war. Maine Calling is just ahead.
Maine Calling is made possible by support from Maine Farmland Trust, working with farmers to grow the future of farming and food in Maine. Learn more at mainefarmlandtrust.org/learn. Welch and Forbes, working with clients to manage the full range of events that come with building wealth. From investments to trustee services, more at welchforbes.com. And by Maine Seacoast Mission, delivering health care, education, and support to islands and coastal Downeast communities. Learn more at seacoastmission.org.
I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. By any measure, Charles Norman Shea is a hero. He saved many lives on D-Day, served in two wars, stood for justice throughout his life, and raised awareness of the service of American Indians in the U.S. military. Charles Shea turns 100 on Thursday. Today, we honor him by discussing his life and legacy. Joining me, Donna Loring, who is a Penobscot author, broadcaster, Army veteran, and former senior advisor on tribal affairs for the state of Maine. Bunny McBride is a journalist, curator, and co-author of the book From Indian Island to Omaha Beach, The D-Day Story of Charles Shea. Another co-author of that book is with us as well, Harold Prince, professor of anthropology at Kansas State University. We invite you to join the conversation. Have you ever met Charles Norman Shea? Have you followed his story? Send us an email, talk@mainepublic.org, post a comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Thank you all for joining us for this hour, but let's start the hour by hearing from Charles Shea himself. Back in 2007, I had the privilege of interviewing him at the Abbey Museum in Bar Harbor. Shea described his experience on Omaha Beach on D-Day. He was 19 years old and trained as a medic.
Once we reached the beach and were out of the water, we had to make a dash for the embankment because that was the only protection that was there. And when I got to the embankment, of course, being a medic, I assisted. I started treating the wounded that had made it to the beach, made it to the embankment. I started treating them, binding up their wounds and so forth. It was just a reaction that I had to go and help them. And I returned to the water. I don't know how I ever did it. And I pulled several men up out of the water to the safety of the, out of the water to the beach. I did what I could for them. I don't know where my strength came from, but I was able to save several lives.
Donna Loring, you're a veteran. When you hear those words and imagine what it was like to be on Omaha Beach on that day, what are you thinking?
Well, I'm thinking it was unimaginable. It's probably like being in the middle of Hades with all those, that sound just blowing your eardrums out and people getting blown apart left and right. I can't imagine it. And it's something that I know stuck with Charles for all of his life.
Yeah.
Very traumatic, yep.
Harold, when we did that interview back in 2007, it was the first time Charles Shea had spoken publicly about that. And I think that that's not uncommon for veterans who have gone through something really, really horrific But I know that you and Bunny have gotten to know Charles Normanchet very well, and you really felt like it was very important for people to know his story. Why was that so important to you both?
The reason really was that I realized that Omaha Beach, for the European Theater of War in World War II, like Iwo Jima for the Pacific Theater of War, but those two battlefields were the ones that have lingered in the popular imagination, whereas many other battles have been forgotten. I can list a string of them, but they will make no sense to most of your audience. So if you're a military historian, you know, but that's where battles were fought with many, both American Indian and Canadian Indian soldiers who fought there. And I realized when Charles mentioned that he had been on Omaha, which came to me as a surprise. We already knew him for years, and he had never mentioned anything. Ironically enough, I used to speak German with his Viennese wife at Indian Island, which is kind of interesting. She was from Vienna, Austria, and had died just before we left. I had heard from other Maine Indian veterans the story that they had been fighting in Europe, and I was also shocked about that. The first one I heard about was Jim Thoma, a Maliseet basket maker outside of Houlton, who had actually also landed on D-Day on Juneau Beach with the Canadian troops. And I had never even thought about that, and that was in early 1982. But that story had always lingered in my mind as a Dutchman and the son of a Dutch resistance fighter. The realization, working with American Indians, a number of whom had been part of the liberation of Europe, that that story was not told. I didn't know anything about it. And so when Charles mentioned Omaha, I first said nothing and left it for a number of days lingering, and then began to realize that Charles' story might be the story that would allow us to tell the stories of people like Jim Thoma and so many other World War II veterans, including Donna's father, who fought in Northern Italy with the 10th Mountain Division. Those stories were simply not told for a major reason, which is that most people, when they go to American Indian reservations, they want to know about moccasins, tribal dances, shamans, you name it. But they don't really think about the fact that many of these Native Americans have traveled all across the world and fought across the world. Among the Penobscot, for example, were not only other Penobscots who fought at Indian Island, but also in the Pacific and even in New Guinea.
I want to return to this discussion about the role of American Indians, specifically Wabanaki soldiers, in just a minute, but let's first delve a little more into Harold himself. Bunny, there is so much now known about Charles Normanchet's service at Omaha Beach. There is now a sculpture and a park and a memorial to him there, but that was not the end of his military service. He continued and continued very heroically in other battles. Tell us about those.
Well, Harold can really speak more to those battles in our shared division of labor. Really, the military research is his forte. And just a quick note about the things we don't know or the things we don't ask. What was fascinating to me was that I had known Charles for a few years before Harold met him. And he and I had talked about countless other things, about his family, about his childhood, but never talked about the war. And Harold was tuned into that because his father was in the resistance. I came from a bunch of pacifists and did not explore that. So it was, this whole journey has been mind-opening to me. And I have to say that part of what drew me to it was that Charles was a battlefield angel. He was a combat medic. He was saving lives rather than taking lives in these just wars. And he's the kind of man you would want by your side when you're mortally wounded. He is steady, measured, he's cautious, but nerves of steel. So all those qualities really drew me to him and his story.
Well, Harold, why don't you talk about that then? After Charles Shea survived Omaha Beach and saved countless lives, he doesn't even know how many, he went on to serve in some other really terrifying battles as well.
Yes, Charles, after having landed at dawn on Omaha Beach, and rescuing people, how many he doesn't know, but it turned out that by noon on D-Day, about half of his regiment was either killed or was severely wounded, many of whom drowned in the rising tide. And the breakthrough was extremely difficult. As a matter of fact, there was a miscalculation by the American high command in terms of Omaha Beach, and there were plans to evacuate the beach at 11 o'clock that morning, which would have meant, of course, that Charles that morning, if he had survived, would have been a captive for the rest of the war. Luckily, that command didn't come through because it was a breakthrough right at that moment that the general watching the slaughter on the beach, when that message didn't come through, he had to call it off because the message, the troops were already through. But the casualties were enormous. If you think about, there were 2,400 casualties, meaning killed and wounded, and a few captured on D-Day alone on Omaha Beach. If you think about that, there were of American Indians on D-Day alone, there were 24 killed in action on D-Day alone. I'm not speaking about the subsequent actions. So I can rattle off a lot of numbers here, but the key thing is that the role of American Indians and Canadian Indians in the invasion has been such that we have forgotten that it was not just Charles who went through, but also Melvin Neptune. Melvin Neptune, also from Indian Island, who had a brother fighting in the Pacific, but he landed about 12 hours after Charles and got the Bronze Star for heroism that night, taking out a machine gun nest. That story we hope to tell through Charles' story as well. So when Charles and other Penobscots, Leslie Banks is another one, when they landed on Omaha Beach in the subsequent weeks, there were a total of seven. One Penobscot was killed in action. His name is almost entirely forgotten now. It's David Lewis, who was killed after landing on Omaha Beach in the weeks after Charles. He was killed in Northeast France. His body was brought back in a coffin in 1949. Back to Indian Island, where he's buried. So when Charles continues to move, he moves with enormous numbers of troops into Normandy, heavy, heavy fighting. Much of Normandy is completely destroyed in the fighting. Many American Indians and Canadian Indians die, as well as, of course, numerous other troops. And then Charles is part of the vanguard of the 1st Division, the 16th Regiment, and is pressing through all the way to the so-called Siegfried Line, which is the frontier, the heavily fortified frontier that the Germans had built to protect the German Empire. And there he's in the Battle of Aachen. Aachen, the big old imperial city of Germany, is for 90% destroyed by late October. Charles is in that battle and then gets into the Battle of the Hürtchen Forest. And many people who know about the Hürtchen Forest, a very obscure fight, but it was worse in many ways than even the invasion in Normandy on D-Day. So Charles had a nervous breakdown there, trying to help a soldier who he's close to. He knew him as Pop, who was mortally wounded in a manhole in the middle of the night during heavy, heavy shelling. And Charles got basically a nervous breakdown and was taken back for about a week, got some pills, he doesn't know what he got, and was sent back to the front line. That was followed by the Battle of the Bulge. And in the Battle of the Bulge were more American Indians than in the Battle of the Little Bighorn, which is hard to imagine, the number of American Indians. No one has ever researched that, but I became very interested in that. And then Charles survives all of that. So does Melvin Neptune, who was only about 5 miles away from him, but they didn't see each other throughout the war, except for on the eve of D-Day itself. Then Charles and his regiment is crossing the Rhine just after the near destruction of the bridge across Remagen, and Charles is captured by the Germans in March 1945 and is then liberated on the 12th of April 1945. And it was basically no fight.
Unbelievable. Wow. Wow. I'm going to go to a caller who's coming in. Michael's calling from Bangor. Hi, Michael. Go ahead.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
Hi. I used to occasionally have lunch with Charles. And at one of these lunches, Charles told me that after World War II, when he returned to Maine, he went, I believe, with his mother to register to vote. And at that time, he was denied. He could not vote in the election that followed World War II, and he was denied the right to vote as well as many other Native people in Maine. And I think when he told me this, he actually was very calm. I was shocked. He was calm. He saw it as something had happened, and his life went on. And he voted in later years, of course. And his demeanor always was optimistic and future oriented. He was very interested in history, and his family's history, was devoted to his family, and to the Penobscot Nation. But I think this fact about voting needs to be stated at a time
yes.
when tribal sovereignty is an important issue.
Michael, thank you so much for your call. Very important point to make, Donna. A very important point that these heroes came back and then could not vote.
There's a really interesting story.
Oh, Bonnie, go ahead. Go ahead.
Yeah, there's a fascinating story about Charles and his family concerning the vote. When he comes back from Korea in 1952 in August, his aunt, Lucy Nicola Pula, who was an activist and a performer and quite a force, and his mother and his other aunt, Pauline, they had been, along with Charles' father and the rest of his family, really had been pushing for the vote. And the point was that Indians living on the reservation could not vote. And so they decided to stage a performative. And they got Charlie to put on his uniform, his medals, his beautiful Master Sergeant stripes, and go down with them to register to vote. And there was a small line when they got there, and they knew what was going to happen. They knew that that the registrar would have to deny a Native American who had just served with valor, not only in the Second World War, but also in Korea. They were going to have to deny him. He was going to be turned away because of that still standing law that Indians not taxed, those still living on the reservations in Maine, could not vote. So it was really, they intended this small attention-grabbing protest. It made it into the newspapers. And then in the next 2 years that followed, they passed a resolution for voting and also to establish places, a registration place for Native Americans in Maine. So Charles learned early on about how to be a public figure making a statement.
Hmm. Thanks for that story. And Michael, thank you for your call. Calling in now is Chief Kirk Francis from the Penobscot Nation. Hi, Chief Francis. Thanks for calling in.
Hey, good morning. It's good to hear you.
You wanted to share a memory of Charles Norman Shea?
Yeah, I'm on travel today. It's great to hear all of you talking about Charles. I know you're getting a lot of the history today, but in my life, Charles has certainly had a huge impact on me and my role as chief. You know, he inducted me in as chief when I was sworn in, and very shortly after I was elected, I started to understand the seriousness and also the amazing history that Charles, hadn't really talked about for a very, very long time. And so I got to go to the French embassy when he got the, he insisted that I go with him. I went and he received the highest non-French citizen award that anybody can get in the Legion of Honor award from President Sarkozy at the time. So I was really proud to be part of that. I'm just proud of the ambassador that he is and the example he sets for people and how people look at Indian people in general. That's a guy that should be emulated and looked at. And his really approach the whole time, whether we're talking about the Native American Veterans Memorial, you know, ferries being named after him, statues in Normandy, you know, all of those things that are happening. You know, he was very instrumental in Native American Veterans Day here in Maine. And, you know, his goal and objective was always to bring attention to all veterans. And he's just such a great ambassador for us. And one of those guys, you know, that you really don't feel worthy of leading at times. And I just appreciate how he's always respected me and supported me. And he turns 100 this year, and I'm hoping to see my old friend pretty soon.
Thursday. It's amazing. Chief Francis, thanks so much for calling and joining the conversation today. Kirk Francis is chief of the Penobscot Nation. We do need to take a break. We will be right back. And a note, this program is a rebroadcast of an earlier show. We are not taking any phone calls or responding to emails or social media posts. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today we're dedicating our program to Charles Norman Shea, who turns 100 this week. Shea is a Penobscot Nation member. He's an American hero. He saved many lives on D-Day and went on to serve in other battles in World War II and the Korean War, and has always been an advocate for other veterans and for peace. Joining us, Bunny McBride and Harold Prince, who co-authored the book From Indian Island to Omaha Beach, The D-Day Story of Charles Shea, and Donna Loring, who is also Penobscot, an author and Army veteran. Join the conversation. Do you know Charlie Shea? Send an email to talk@mainpublic.org, comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Before we move on, Harold, I wanted to tell you that, and I wanted to tell our audience that we had very much hoped to have Charlie Shea on Maine Calling today. He lives in France now, and it was going to be a little challenge to make sure that could all work technically. But in the end, it was not possible. And Harold, I know you've spoken with him recently.
Yes, it was not possible because, as you mentioned before, Charles hopes to turn 100 on Thursday. And that means with all the mileage on those knees that he has commented on, those knees carried him through two wars, he said at one point. But he they had a kind of an early celebration in France of his birthday at a big barbecue. And it was quite warm in Normandy, and he had told us earlier these long sitting situations make his legs go asleep. So he had difficulty walking. But anyway, the point is that he may have been dehydrated that day and has not been all that well ever since. So he did not show up on the actual June 6th celebration. There were a group of Comanche Indians who came to Utah Beach, where their ancestors had been co-talkers. They had hoped to see him, and they were told at the time that he was unwell. And that was a short description that's correct, but he's in good spirits. He's very well taken care of, and so on.
Donna.
Yeah, before you leave for the topic about Charles, I'd like to thank Harold and Bunny, because without them, you'd never know about Charles. They're the ones who basically started him to discuss his history and his experience. And it's kind of ironic, kind of, that his veterans experience has really blown up. I mean, really, people want to know more about it. And the other thing I want to say is that when Charles went to vote and they refused him, was what, 1952? I believe it was 1954 that the federal vote was allowed. And it wasn't until 1967 that the state allowed us to vote in state elections. But you know, you could have a whole program on the voting rights and that sort of thing, because it's a very complicated issue. I just wanted to say that.
Yeah, I think that's really important. Thank you, Donna, for that. And we will talk more about Charles Norman Shea. We'll hear his voice again. He gave an interview to the Associated Press just earlier this year, and we have a clip of that. But right now, calling in John Diefenbacher-Krall, who's executive director of the Wabanaki Alliance. John, it was mentioned the Native American Veterans Day. It was just this past Friday. You did a whole series of social media posts to highlight the service of Wabanaki tribal members, and the first was Charles Norman Shea. And I wanted to step back, and we have been talking about the service of so many American Indians, but especially those serving from the Penobscot Nation. More than half of the young men on the island were serving in World War II, when Charles was one of very many, correct?
Yes, though the guests on your program, Jennifer, and thank you for inviting me to be with you and your audience this morning, would know better. But Charles Shea, when someone is in the presence of him, you just know that you're in the presence of an extraordinary man. If there was a definition of dignity and stature, you could put Charles Shea. So that's the regard that he's held in, I know, both in the Penobscot community and Wabanaki community. But I do appreciate you mentioning, Jennifer, these other Wabanaki veterans may not have gotten as much acclaim as Charles Shea, but their sacrifices, nonetheless, often were as significant. And we started, you know, last week on June 16th. It was obvious to lead with Charles Shea, because he's such a hero. He's such a giant in all that he's done. But we followed that with a daily social media post with Hilda Lewis, who's a Sabaic citizen, was a nurse and achieved the rank of lieutenant colonel. Then on June 18th, Randy Sillaboy, who's a Mi'kmaq nation and helped to keep lots of equipment running well, so that soldiers could fight. We did Diane Dunn on June 19th, and many listeners may be aware that she is currently serving as the Adjutant General in Maine. June 20th, Andrew Phillips from the Mi'kmaq Nation. June 21st, we culminated that series with Frank Toma from Madoc-McCook at the Passamaquoddy Tribe. And we also did a post you've mentioned today, Jennifer, and thank you, Native American Veterans Day, which, thanks to the work of then Passamaquoddy Tribal Representative Donald Sock-Toma, there is a proclamation each year that is to be issued by the governor of the state of Maine naming June 21st. And Donald picked that day, the summer solstice, as a very significant day to the Wabanaki and many indigenous peoples. And so that is an important day. And also, I don't think it's been mentioned this morning. I think I've listened to all the program. One of your guests, Donna Loring, co-authored with Donald Sock-Toma in the Bangor Daily News, the fifth Wabanaki Voices column, The Time-Honored Valor and Sacrifice of Wabanaki Veterans. So I encourage the listeners to go check out that op-ed. And one of the ironies that Donna and Donald point out is that these tremendous sacrifices, sometimes people sacrificing their lives, and yet they were not allowed to vote back home.
John, thank you for that. And if you could hold on for just a minute, Donna Loring, I want to talk about the piece that you wrote, because I learned something from it. Something about your great grandfather seven times over. We have heard, and we do know, that Wabanaki people have served in every U.S. war, but we're talking about the Revolutionary War. Tell us about your seventh great-grandfather.
Well, I didn't know him personally. I'm not that old.
Now, that would be impressive.
Yeah. But I'll tell you, historically, what I do know is basically owed to researchers like Harold. This guy, Harold, he's really... astute researcher, and basically he's the one that pointed out that Chief Orono is related to me, and I sort of checked it out on the island and with that genealogical chart, and sure enough, yes,
Chief Joseph Orono. Yeah, go on.
Yeah, but he was also, and correct me, Harold, here, I believe that he was also very religious. He's a Catholic. And he ended up, from what I understand, he ended up not living on the island. I think he moved, and actually towards the latter part of his life was in the Orono area, and possibly passed away there. I'm not sure. But, you know, that's about all I can tell you.
But he encouraged others to volunteer for service for the Americans, the U.S. against England in the Revolutionary War, correct?
Yep, absolutely. And of course, he saw the way that England had treated the native people, and the tribes basically got along much better with the French. And he felt that had England won that war, that they would be treated very badly. And so we decided, or he made the point that whatever happened to the Americans would even be worse happening to the native people. So that's why, and he was basically persuasive in that argument.
All right. Well, John, before we say goodbye, is there anything you'd like to add about the service of Wabanaki veterans?
Just that they've served at such high rates, higher than any other demographic group in our country, and yet consistently denied their rights. And if you want to learn more about the struggle of Wabanaki peoples to have their inherent sovereignty recognized, please visit the Wabanaki Alliance website, wabanakialliance.com.
Well, John Diefenbrocker-Krall, thanks so much for calling in. John is executive director of the Wabanaki Alliance. Harold, go ahead.
Yeah, a quick follow-up to what Donna was saying and what earlier was mentioned about the selection of June 21st as Native American Veterans Day. And that was also the day that Chief Joseph Orono, who was not only Donna's great-great-great-great-great-grandfather, seven times removed, but also Charles' forefather, and he's also a descendant of Joseph Orono. And Charles was aware of that, and so when the famous offer to pledge support to the rebels, the colonists in the uprising at the battle, just after the Battle of Bunker Hill, Chief Joseph Orono was in Watertown outside of Boston at a very high age already at that time. And he pledged the support of the Wabanaki Alliance. And so that was extremely dangerous. And half of the Wabanaki Alliance lost their homeland in the sense that the British Crown maintained control over Nova Scotia and New Brunswick, which is the homeland of the Mi'kmaq and the Maliseet primarily. And Maine at that time was split at the Penobscot River. So when the fort at what is now called Castine was taken by the British in 1779, Chief Orono and many of the Penobscots who had sided with the rebels, the colonists, they had to flee Indian Island. And they lived in exile in what is now the Winslow area on the Upper Kennebec. So a lot of people have no idea about the sacrifices made by Wabanaki warriors in the Revolutionary War. And if you look at history books, there's a book about the Maine in the Revolutionary War, and you look for the role of American Indians in there, and you will see almost nothing there. It's amazing to see that, because the writing out of history of indigenous peoples in the United States and in Canada is really wrong, because people have a totally false idea about how the country was formed from shining sea to shining sea, the Atlantic to the Pacific, but has come, of course, at the expense of tremendous losses on the part of indigenous peoples who have been sacrificing their lives, or were told to sacrifice their lives, not always voluntarily, that they moved into battlefields. Mm-hmm. And yet, as we have mentioned several times before, were not allowed to vote, yet they were asked to fight.
Bunny.
Yeah, exactly. And Charles' mother wrote about that. She did a small booklet called The History of the Penobscots, and she prepared it for a pageant that was held in 1941. And that pageant, in that pageant, it included a reenactment of the massacre at Norwich Walk by English troops, where Penobscots and the priest in this mission village in the Upper Kennebec were murdered. And in that pamphlet, she tells that story. And in this pageant, they reenacted that story. Charles played one of the Penobscot warriors in the reenactment of that. And in his mother's booklet, one of the things she talks about, she says, "I have four sons who are serving in the military, and yet we are not allowed to vote. We are put in the same class as paupers and insane people, basically." So it was something that was on that family's radar for a long time, was to turn that around.
We do need to take another quick break. We are discussing the life and legacy of Charles Norman Shea. If you'd like to join the conversation, our phone number 1-800-399-3566. If you're quick, you could send an email, talk@mainpublic.org. We will hear from Charles Shea from an interview just done earlier this year when we come back. This program is a rebroadcast of an earlier show, so we are not taking any phone calls or responding to emails or social media posts. Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. We are discussing the exceptional life of Charles Norman Shea of the Penobscot Nation, who turns 100 on Thursday. My guest today, Penobscot leader Donna Loring, and also the co-authors of Shea's biography, Bunny McBride and Harold Prinz. Join our conversation, 1-800-399-3566. Find us on social media, or if you're super fast, you can send a brief email to talk@mainpublic.org. Somebody used the word, I believe it was John, about how dignified Charles Shea is. He's dignified and he's very humble. He never brags about his service and he never glorifies war. Earlier this year, in an interview, his message was a plea for peace.
I lost many close friends, yes. I had been given a job, and it was up to me to complete my job. I did not have time to worry about my situation of being there and perhaps losing my life. There was no time for this. I would like to see it has had more effect on the whole world, but it has not, because you see that we go from one war to the next. There will always be wars with people and nations that cannot get along with each other.
Buddy McBride, you've had many, many deep conversations with Charles Norman Shea, with Charlie Shea. When you hear him say this at age 99, what are you thinking about?
It's such a stunningly poignant statement that this person who has such a long view on life and has been through two major wars and has heard about countless others and has spent so much of his life, later life, walking through the cemeteries and looking at the fallen places, at the markers of his fallen comrades. I think to me it's a call to another kind of arms, and it's a call to be more vigorous, more diligent in international communications and diplomacy, and for citizens to be active in voting themselves, for taking responsibility for our futures and not sitting by the sidelines. That's certainly something that he has done. I mean, he began his senior activism the year, the year his wife died, and they had been, married for decades, and she was his dearest comrades. Many people could justify closing up their life at that point, but his really began in a new and powerful way. I think in particular, the moment he went back to Omaha and did his first sacred fire ritual by himself. I mean, Harold and I were there witnessing, but there was not a crowd. And I remember him saying afterwards, we were talking about what had he said when in this silence, what was he thinking? And he said, I was telling my comrades, I'm showing you my respect. I know that I will soon be joining you, but my death will not be like yours here, surrounded by the cruel chaos of combat. Those are his words, and that's his hope. And while he's not very hopeful about peace, I think that's a charge to us to be the opposite and to reach for it with renewed vigor.
Mm, that's just so moving, Bunny. I'm so glad you brought up the ceremony, because you said his first ceremony. And what you're talking about is the fact that every year he is able, Charles Norman Shea does a personal ceremony at Omaha Beach. Can you describe that and tell us about that?
Yes, there's the public one that is done at the Charles Shea Park, Charles Shea Indian Park Memorial, but there's also the private one that he's done himself. And that is something, when he did the first one in 2007 on Omaha Beach, which Harold filmed, but that film has not been shared yet. He had never led a ceremony himself. He was exceedingly nervous about it. He didn't sleep at all the night before. And I remember walking behind him, and he was carrying this little bag, and in it he had his sticks of wood, he had an eagle feather, he had sage, he had sweet grass, and he had his matches. And he, you know, got on his knees, bent, he was 83 at the time, and kindled up his little fire. And then he stood, and he, with his eagle feather in his hand, and he dropped the tobacco into the fire. And I remember it sparking and, you know, floating up and into the air. And he did that with, and then he said a prayer in silence, facing in all four directions. And he did that with the tobacco, and he washed himself in the smoke of it. And when he was done, it was amazing. It was a misty morning. And when he finished, the sun actually came out. And he said that after doing the ceremony, he was in a really sad mood and had to take a few more moments to pray. But in the end, it made him feel better. He said then he covered up his fire with sand, and he felt it had served a purpose. He had honored his comrades who had fallen, the ones he couldn't save, because we talk about the ones he saved, but what weighed on him heavily was all the ones he couldn't save. And that ceremony gave him peace of mind. And going forward, he has handed over the ceremony at the Charles Shea Indian Park for the celebration each year. And that will be carried forward as part of the ceremony there. And as Harold has mentioned many times, and Donna and other people here this morning, other people are picking up the feather and continuing his message.
Harold.
Yeah, quick. Before we left after you interviewed him, Jennifer, in 2007, there was a special ceremony held by Charles' nephew, Tim Shea, the sculptor. And it was a special ceremony, a spiritual ceremony, whereby Charles participated in that ceremony. I do not want to divulge the intimate details of that ceremony, because it was a special closed ceremony for him, but it was meant to guide him into a very difficult terrain back to Omaha Beach, which he had last been at on June 6th, what now is 80 years ago. And so it was a very special ceremony. And Tim Shea is also the one who was commissioned to do both the sculpture at Omaha Beach from granite that was mined in Normandy, a beautiful large turtle sculpture, and then later one at Indian Island. And those two sculptures of two turtles, they are looking at each other across the Atlantic Ocean between Normandy and Indian Island. And Tim is tomorrow, as he told us a few days ago, is leaving for Normandy to be at his uncle's side on his birthday on Thursday.
Mm. And Donna Loring, speaking of that, I wanted to ask you about the turtles. What is the significance of the fact that at the Charles Shea Indian Memorial on Omaha Beach, it is a turtle that is representing him?
Is that a question to me?
Oh, I was going to ask Donna. Donna, do you know?
Sorry, yeah. No, I'm not really sure.
Okay, Harold, go ahead.
Yeah, Charles, as you know, Jennifer and many people in the audience will know, many of the Penobscot and Passamaquoddy and Maliseet and Mi'kmaq families have totem animals. And the turtle is not Charles' totem animal. The Nicola have the otter, for example. And I don't want to get into all these totem figures, but Charles has always been fascinated by the turtle, in part because of the ancient, widespread Native American story about the Earth as being Turtle Island. And so it's Turtle Island is North America, right? But Charles also saw in the coat of arms of the 16th Regiment, there's a design in that coat of arms that actually looks like a turtle. It's not a turtle, but it has the outline of a turtle. It's actually a fort on Cuba, on the island of Cuba, where the 16th Regiment fought in the Cuban-American War. But we talked about it at the time. And when Charles left for his first pilgrimage to Omaha Beach, Tim's wife, ex-wife, a Navajo artist, then embroidered a gorgeous deer hide vest with a turtle on his back. And if you look at the early photographs, you see Charles wearing that vest with the turtle on his back. And Chief Kirk Francis was earlier mentioning the ceremony at the embassy in Washington, D.C., when then-President Sarkozy inducted Charles into the Légion d'honneur, the Legion of Honor. Charles was wearing that vest with that turtle on his back.
Mm. Teresa Secord wrote on Facebook, Charles's family legacy of Penobscot basketry is highlighted in an exhibit at the Farnsworth Museum in Rockland now through January. His parents and then his nephew long operated a basket sales tent and later a shop and gallery in Lincolnville Beach. And Donna, Charles's family, she mentions the shop in Lincolnville Beach. People will know when Charles lived on Indian Island, he lived right next to another very famous landmark. Do you want to tell us about the teepee, which is ironic because Penobscot Indians do not live in teepees?
Well, actually, I believe that teepee was built by Lucy.
Yes. Lucy Poole. Yeah.
Yeah.
His famous aunt.
Exactly. So, I mean, yeah. So, and Bruce Hula was Kiowa. So is that right? You get that right? Kiowa. So, yeah, that's where the teepee came from, was that, that scenario.
Yeah. And for many years, that was a landmark, right? People would go there and visit Lucy. Yeah. Funny.
Yeah. It was built to house, Lucy and her Kiowa husband, Bruce's, novelty shop. And it's, you know, 10 meters high and it's eight meters in diameter. It's really large. And they would have young kids come down and dance there. And they would, and they sold their wares there. And I think one reason they wanted the bridge, not only because of safety reasons, but their teepee was right at the old ferry landing and thereby at the threshold of the bridge. It would certainly not harm business for them either.
An email from Todd. Todd just wants to talk about Charles's extraordinary French ancestry in addition to everything else. But of course, we're almost out of time. So, Harold, I'm going to just leave it at your nodding. And Bunny, go out and finish your thought, please.
I was just going to mention what Charles did with the interior of the teepee. It's part of his legacy. He commissioned his nephew, Calvin Francis, to paint the entire interior of the mural of the teepee is in a mural that captures the Penobscot riverine habitat and his family history. It includes an image of his grandfather, his parents, his Aunt Lucy, and Uncle Bruce. And it's a lot of fun to go in and see how many of the animals of the Penobscot River habitat you can find. It's a remarkable creation.
All right. Well, thank you all so much for joining us for this hour. We didn't even talk about the new ferry that's been named the Charles Norman Shea, but I really appreciate all of your memories and perspective. Donna Loring, Penobscot author, broadcaster, and Army veteran. Bunny McBride, journalist, curator, and co-author of From Indian Island to Omaha Beach, The D-Day Story of Charles Shea. And Harold Prince, also co-author of that book and professor of anthropology at Kansas State University. It's because of Harold and Bunny that the world knows Charles Norman Shea's story. Today's sound engineer, Sandra Harris. Main Calling produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Main Calling on Maine Public Radio.